Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we are reading from the November 10th, 2023 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week has a very large drawing of newly elected House Speaker Mike Johnson. He's got a pleasant smile on his face, looking directly at the viewer. His hands are folded in prayer fashion in front of his chest. Above his head is a halo. On his right shoulder is a diminutive Donald Trump, who is leaning over and speaking into his ear. In the background behind him is the Capitol building. The sky is blue with clouds. The headline is, "A True Believer: What Johnson's Election as House Speaker Means for the GOP and the Nation." And we get that story on the Talking Points page later in the show. But we'll start with the first main story. Israel ramps up its ground war on Hamas. What happened? Israel intensified its offensive against Hamas this week in what officials called a new phase of the war in Gaza, as aid groups warned of a worsening humanitarian crisis in the Palestinian territory. Israeli tanks and troops crossed the border and were moving steadily toward Gaza City, the enclave's largest population center and a Hamas stronghold, from at least three directions. At the same time, Israel stepped up an aerial and artillery strikes on the territory, a bombardment that has damaged or destroyed tens of thousands of buildings and killed more than 8,700 Palestinians, according to Gaza's Hamas-run health ministry. Health officials said at least 50 civilians were killed and hundreds more wounded in an airstrike on the Jabalia refugee camp. Israel said it had targeted an underground bunker where a senior Hamas official who helped plan the October 7th massacre was hiding. A nearby hospital was overwhelmed as Gazans pulled dozens of bodies, including many children, from the rubble. "This is simply genocide," said Dr. Marwan Sultan, director of the Indonesian hospital. Limited amounts of aid are arriving in Gaza from neighboring Egypt, but food, water, and medicine are increasingly scarce, and nearly half of Gaza's 35 hospitals have shut down because of a shortage of fuel, which Israel is not allowing in, over concerns it will be used by Hamas. International calls for a humanitarian ceasefire were mounting, but Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu flatly refused to halt the offensive, in which at least 16 Israeli soldiers have been killed. Calls for a ceasefire are calls for Israel to surrender to Hamas, he said. This is a time for war. What the editorial said. Each day, Gaza's humanitarian nightmare grows ever more grim, said the Financial Times. Israel has every right to defend itself after Hamas' barbarous assault, but its collective punishment of Gaza's 2 million residents must stop. President Biden and other allies must pressure Israel to respect the rules of war and lift its siege. And as fury grows in the Muslim world, those leaders must steer Israel toward a more plausible plan to counter Hamas, one that does not drive Israel and the region into the abyss. As Americans survey the devastating imagery from Gaza, they must remember one thing, said the St. Louis Dispatch. There is no moral equivalence between Israel and Hamas. Israel's counteroffensive will unavoidably cost civilian lives, but there's a world of difference between that and the deliberate targeting of innocents, which Hamas did with its October 7th slaughter of 1,400 Israelis. A vibrant democracy that shares America's values is at war with a savage, terrorist enemy bent on its eradication. Americans who side against Israel are, by definition, siding with that. What the columnist said: the limited ground incursion underway is a far cry from the thundering assault Israel had been signaling, said the economist. Several forces are at work. Some Israeli leaders feared a major offensive would play into Hamas's hands by drawing troops into urban terrain rigged with ambushes and booby traps. Some wanted to leave room for a deal to free some of the roughly 240 hostages seized by Hamas on October 7th. In progress seems to be a slower campaign that will rely in effect on siege tactics and take months, perhaps a year. That offensive is only a few days old, but already United Nations officials and Western do-gooders are demanding a ceasefire, said Noah Rothman in National Review. But if Israel puts down its weapons, Hamas will be the victor. The terrorist group would use any pause in hostilities to rearm and regroup, and Israeli civilians would be left facing the prospect of another genocidal massacre of their friends, family, and neighbors at some indefinite but predictable future date. Israel seems ready to give Hamas just what they were hoping for, said Eric Alterman in the New Republic. As civilian bodies pile up and Gaza is reduced to rubble, Israel's reputation in the world will suffer tremendous damage. It has no clear notion of what a victory over its shadowy enemy would look like or what would follow. The dream of integrating Israel into the Arab world via the Abraham Accords is over. The war will not end well for anybody, but it will be the Palestinians who suffer most. Controversy of the week: decolonization, a new excuse for anti-Semitism. As a 70-year-old Jewish man, I've heard anti-Semitic things from time to time through my life, said Erwin Kimerinsky in the Los Angeles Times. But nothing prepared me for the outpouring of anti-Jewish hate on college campuses, including at Berkeley Law School, where I'm the dean, that followed the slaughter of 1,400 Israelis on October 7th. And that explosion of anti-Semitism has only intensified as Israel has struck back against the terrorists in Gaza. At Berkeley, I've been accused of being part of a Zionist conspiracy. At George Washington University, pro-Hamas students projected "Glory to our martyrs" on a campus building. At Cooper Union in New York City, terrified Jewish students had to lock themselves in a library while pro-Palestinian protesters pounded on the door. At Cornell, a student was arrested for allegedly threatening to slit the throats of Jews on campus. These people will all deny they're anti-Semitic, said Alex Olshansky in Tablet. The new euphemism is decolonization, part of a left-wing academic doctrine that justifies Palestinian violence against Israelis as part of a global struggle for social justice. But it's a funny kind of social justice that revels in raped teenagers and headless babies, and that wants to start the bloody work of decolonization with the planet's only Jewish state. Most leftists were horrified by the October 7th attacks, said Karen Atia in the Washington Post. But we're also horrified by Israel's brutal war in Gaza and its continued occupation of Palestinian land. The struggle of Palestinians echoes the decolonization struggle of Africans who sought to free themselves from the violent imperialism of Britain and France, the same powers who carved up and divided the Middle East. The toxic legacy of Western colonization endures in the oppression of racial minorities here in America, and it should be no surprise that many black Americans feel solidarity with Palestinians. Don't be fooled by the masks of humanitarianism and justice, said Simon Sebag Montefiore in The Atlantic. A favorite chant at anti-colonial protest in the U.S. and Europe is, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free." The meaning of that phrase is clear. The 7 million Israeli Jews who live between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean must be killed or deported. How could any progressive support this genocidal agenda? Because the decolonization narrative has dehumanized Israelis to the extent that any barbarity can be excused. Under this simplistic doctrine, Israelis, about half of whom are the descendants of Jews from Arab and Persian lands, are classed as white or white adjacent. That means, by definition, they cannot be victims. For the record, Jews have lived in Israel for thousands of years, said Rich Lowry in National Review. But what would it matter if the decolonizers were right and Jews had only been living there since modern Israel's independence in 1948? Every nation owes its borders and demographics to millennia of conquest and defeat, migration and exile. Does the anti-colonial movement want to roll back human history, repatriating ethnic groups, the Arabs, Turks, and countless others, to their original homes and slaughtering those who won't go quietly? That isn't a new idea, said Adam Kirsch in the Wall Street Journal. The Nazi slogan, "Blood and Soil," conveyed the belief that land can only truly belong to its primeval inhabitants. That ideology resulted in the murder of 6 million Jews in the Holocaust. For members of the left to embrace this hideous notion here in the 21st century is sheer moral derangement. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for parental rights after an Italian court ruled that a 75-year-old woman in the city of Pavia can evict her two freeloading adult sons, ages 40 and 42, from her home. Judge Simona Caterbi said the two bambacocini, or big babies, have until December 18th to move out. It was a good week for joy bundles after Sonny, a baby boy weighing 14 pounds, 8 ounces, was born to a couple in Cambridge, Ontario. "We just make big babies," said Mother Brittany Ayers, noting that two of Sonny's four siblings weighed more than 13 pounds at birth. And it was a good week for standing tall after three shoemakers told Politico that Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, 5'11", almost certainly wears height-boosting lifts in his cowboy boots, possibly to reduce the height gap between him and fellow GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump, 6'3". But it was a bad week for rites of passage after a survey of Gen Z moviegoers found that most want less romance and fewer sex scenes in Hollywood films. "When things get steamy on screen," one 20-year-old told researchers, "my friends and I maybe awkwardly bear through it." It was a bad week for giving back after a charity store in Wales asked the public to please stop donating used and unused marital aids for resale. The children's charity said it always appreciated donations, but these aren't quite the sort of toys we're looking for. Finally, it was a bad week for fast food after a firefighter in Washington, D.C. was fired for stopping to grab a meal at Chick-fil-A while responding to an emergency call for a woman suffering chest pain. The now ex-firefighter said he spent literally a few minutes tops at the restaurant. The briefing this week titled The Fight Against Malaria. After declining for decades, deaths from the disease are suddenly on the rise. What's changed? How many people die from malaria? The mosquito-borne disease currently kills some 620,000 people a year, about 80% of them children under five in sub-Saharan Africa. That makes the mosquito the world's deadliest animal, and malaria, which is caused by a single-cell parasite and can fatally block the flow of blood to organs, one of the deadliest diseases in human history. For much of the past two decades, malaria's death toll had been trending downward, the result of sustained investments from governments and nonprofits in prevention tools such as insecticides and mosquito nets. From 2000 to 2015, global malaria deaths fell by nearly 50%, and deaths among under fives dropped by almost 60%. But total deaths are now rising, climbing about 8% from 2019 to 2021. By 2040, more than 5 billion people worldwide could be at risk of contracting the disease, according to a Washington Post analysis. It seems as though the mosquitoes are winning, said Eric Ochomo, a medical entomologist in Kenya. What's causing the surge? In part, it's because mosquitoes have evolved to overcome our best bug-fighting tools. The insects have developed resistance to commonly used insecticide sprays and have adapted their behaviors to defeat insecticide-treated bed nets. The Anopheles funestus species, for example, was once thought to mostly bite sleepers at night. It now bites people outdoors in the daytime. Meanwhile, an invasive South Asian mosquito species that is resistant to insecticides and thrives in urban environments, Anopheles stephensi, has started to spread across the center of Africa. In 2012, when the species was first detected in Djibouti, that tiny East African nation recorded only 27 cases of malaria. In 2020, it recorded more than 70,000, most in the capital, Djibouti City. Every African city is at risk of facing what we're confronting now, said Djiboutian health official Abdulila Ahmed Abdi. And A. stephensi isn't the only dangerous mosquito that's expanding its range. Climate change is allowing other species to push into new areas. Why is that happening? Malaria parasites and the mosquitoes that carry them do best in hot, humid, rainy climates. About 80 degrees is their sweet spot. And the number of areas with those exact conditions is increasing as global temperatures go up and rainy seasons get longer and more extreme. Mozambique's high-altitude Mandimba district, which is cooler than many other parts of the southern African country, has seen malaria cases climb 20% since 2017 as the mercury has crept higher. Extreme weather events, which are made more likely by climate change, can also send cases spiking. Cyclones can crack walls and floors, opening gaps for mosquitoes. Floods leave standing water in which mosquitoes lay their eggs. Droughts, meanwhile, encourage people to store more water in containers, which are also ideal breeding sites. Unica Cardoso, a 35-year-old Mozambican, tested positive for malaria during Mozambique's winter, when colder, drier weather usually decreases transmission. "I am not surprised anymore," she said, "but it is not normal." Can vaccines help curb cases? Targeting the Plasmodium parasites that cause malaria has proved tricky because they have a multi-stage life cycle and are constantly evolving. But in 2021, the World Health Organization approved the first malaria shot for children, the result of decades of research and more than $1 billion in investment. And last month, the organization approved a second vaccine, which is cheaper and more effective. The latest shot reduced symptomatic cases and trials by 75% and could mean tens of thousands of children's lives will be saved every year, said WHO official Dr. Mary Hamill. Yet while researchers hail this breakthrough, many recognize it will not spell the end of malaria. Many poor families will find it difficult to travel to clinics for the vaccination schedule, which requires four shots between the ages of 5 months and 2 years. For those in conflict zones, such travel will be impossible. Large swaths of Africa will not be able to receive this, said malaria expert Nick White. How else are researchers battling malaria? Some scientists are betting on genetically modified mosquitoes. On the island nation of Sao Tome in Principe, 200 miles off Africa's west coast, University of California researchers are aiming to replace local mosquitoes with lab-tweaked insects that can't transmit the malaria parasite. If the modified mosquitoes mate with wild mosquitoes, they could render nearly every insect immune to the parasite in a few generations, mere months for mosquitoes. Another project from British biotech firm Oxitec and backed by Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is modifying male mosquitoes to ensure they have only male progeny. Unlike female mosquitoes, males don't bite and so can't spread the disease. Will these projects work? Some researchers are unsure if wild mosquitoes will desire genetically modified mates, and altering the genetics of entire mosquito populations is controversial. Mosquitoes are a critical part of many ecosystems, pollinating flowers and providing a major food source for birds, bats, fish, frogs, and more. Still, some scientists say such concerns are outweighed by the possibility of ending so much human suffering. We may not know what may happen, said Abdoulaye Diabate, who leads a mosquito genetics program in Burkina Faso, but we know what is happening today. 600,000 people are dying of malaria, and we need to fix it. A mosquito threat in the U.S. Mosquitoes and the diseases they carry are on the move around the world, and America isn't immune. At least 9 locally acquired malaria infections have been detected in the U.S. this year, 7 in Florida, and 1 each in Texas and Maryland. These are the first malaria cases not linked to foreign travel to appear in the U.S. in 20 years. Cases of other mosquito-borne diseases are also climbing. In August, Alabama reported that one person had died of Eastern equine encephalitis, which has a 30% fatality rate and can leave survivors with neurological problems, and another had been infected. And dengue, which causes excruciating joint pain and is endemic to Puerto Rico and other U.S. territories, is appearing in new places. A locally acquired infection was for the first time detected in California last month. Florida has seen at least 10 local cases so far this year. There's no indication of a looming crisis in the U.S., said dengue expert Alex Perkins, but the expectation that the disease will be a growing problem is reasonable. Moving on to the best columns of the week. The first two come from the U.S., starting with a party dominated by radicals. Donald Trump's MAGA movement has radicalized millions of Americans, said Jennifer Rubin. A third of Republicans recently surveyed by the Public Religion Research Institute now agree that our country has gotten so far off track that true American patriots may have to resort to violence in order to save our country. Nearly half of Republicans believe we need a leader who is willing to break some rules to fix what's wrong. Support for violence and an authoritarian leader has actually risen since Trump left office. Tens of millions of people now hold these dangerous anti-democratic views. The poll shows a sharp split in American society, with a vocal, angry, energized minority on the right, especially those who identify as Christian evangelicals, holding views on abortion, the 2020 election, racism, and Trump's legal troubles that are far more extreme than the views of a majority of Americans. Most Republicans even say they believe God intended America to be a white Christian society. Even if Trump never returns to the White House, reintegrating a large segment of our population into reality-based, multiracial, multicultural democracy will be the great challenge of our time. The surprising increase in abortions. After the Supreme Court overturned Roe, nearly everyone expected the number of abortions performed in the U.S. to sharply decline, said Rose Horowitz. But abortion rates actually increased slightly over the past year, according to separate surveys by the Society of Family Planning and the Guttmacher Institute. That's largely because even as red states have choked off access to abortion, blue states have widened it, and thousands of women are traveling to clinics in states where abortion remains legal, many with the financial and logistical help of pro-choice organizations. At the same time, many women with unwanted pregnancies ordered abortion pills from doctors, pharmacies, and organizations like Aid Access that ship into the red states. It just doesn't work to make abortion illegal, said Linda Prine, a doctor and reproductive rights activist. Red state laws did, however, force thousands of women who are poor and uneducated to give birth. They also forced thousands of other women to spend money and time to travel to out-of-state clinics, where waiting lists sometimes delay the procedure by agonizing weeks. State abortion bans will never end the demand for abortion. They can only punish women who seek control over their reproductive lives. This column comes from Ukraine. It's getting hard to keep up our spirits. Ukrainians are heading into a second grim winter, said Mykhailo Dubinansky. As the cold begins to bite in a land still at war, we are facing another round of blackouts and heat shortages, plus a decline in morale. At least last year, when we lit candles and huddled around phone charging stations, we had fresh memories of the liberation of Kharkiv Oblast and Kherson to sustain us, in the hope that similar sweeping victories against Russia lay ahead. Yet though our soldiers achieved a great deal this year and are now better equipped to handle air raids and infrastructure attacks, the war has been at a near stalemate for months, and we are little closer to the dream of a Ukraine whole and free. Back in October 2022, the intelligence chief, Lieutenant General Kirilo Budanov, predicted we'd retake Crimea by the next spring. We were disappointed then, and at this point, we hardly dare to hope. More and more families are facing the harsh truth that the government might ask us not just to conserve food and energy, but also to send their loved ones to replace the fallen on the front lines. This is the new normal, and it will almost certainly be our reality through 2024 and even beyond. We're not losing, but we're not winning either. And the shortage of optimism is palpable. The last word, our in-depth article. chasing the reptilian invaders. Half a century ago, caimans were brought to the U.S. from South America for the leather and pet trade, said Frieda Creer in the New York Times. Then, some of them got loose. Sidney Godfrey was sitting in the passenger seat of a truck slowly cruising over a levee one night in 2018. This far into Florida's dry season, the air was thick with the smell of mud wafting up from the exposed canals and wetlands along the edge of Biscayne Bay, south of Miami. Godfrey, a wildlife biologist, kept his gaze and his headlight lamp pointed down to light up the water at the base of the levee. The glint of a reptilian eye came from a grove of Australian pine below. The hunt was underway. It was Godfrey's first night surveying with the Croc Docs, the nickname for a University of Florida lab based in Fort Lauderdale. He and Ed Metzger, that evening's survey leader, stepped out of the truck and started making their way down to the target. They soon found themselves wading through muck. Each step dredged up the smell of dead and decaying things. The owner of the shining eyes had spotted the pair and was doing his best to move away. But the researchers persisted, slowly, painfully, wading toward an animal that was neither a trademark Florida gator nor a native crocodile. Their quarry was instead a six-foot-long spectacled caiman. The caimans of southern Florida are not as well known as their alligator cousins. Half a century ago, caimans were taken from their homelands in tropical wetlands of Latin America and brought to the United States for the leather and pet trades. Most of the hundreds of thousands of caimans imported into the United States during the 1970s died, but a few held out in Florida's southernmost corner. Like many invasive species in Florida, they've become a nuisance. Scientific understanding of the effects of invasive caimans is still evolving, but researchers have spotted signs that caimans might crowd out American alligators and American crocodiles while preying on vulnerable indigenous species, and the animals are more aggressive when cornered than native crocodilians, potentially putting people at risk of attacks. Over the past decade, the Croc Docs have run surveys across Miami-Dade County trying to understand the lives of these elusive predators. This isn't idle curiosity. By learning about caimans, the lab has been working to bring their numbers under control. Its goals shared with state and federal agencies, including the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and it's a goal that may be attainable. The crew has spotted fewer and fewer caimans along survey routes in recent years. In a study published in August, researchers found that the area's caiman populations might be on the decline. If so, the caiman could become one of the few invasive species that Florida manages to get rid of, or at least get under control. Godfrey has had that possibility in mind ever since that first night in 2018. After chasing the caiman through the brush, Metzger was able to wrangle a snare around its snout. When it tired itself out, the two men returned to the truck, caiman in tow. "The rush of the capture kind of got me hooked," Godfrey recalled. "It was a life-altering moment." 2 months later, he was head surveyor for the Caiman Project. The story of how caimans came to the United States starts with alligators. Americans developed a taste for alligator leather in the 1800s. Millions of the animals were slaughtered to meet the growing demand for alligator hide. By the 1960s, their numbers had declined so precipitously that southern states began limiting or banning the alligator trade. Then, alligators received federal protection in 1967. The leather industry pivoted to harvesting the ample supply of caimans in the tropical wetlands of Central and South America. Savvy business people soon brought live caimans stateside. More than 112,000 caimans were imported in 1970 alone according to a Fish and Wildlife Service estimate. From there, some animals were set up on farms to be raised for leather. But hatchlings were also sold at gas stations and grocery stores as pets. Most of the caimans sold in stores were spectacled caimans, a species so named for the glasses-like ridge that runs along their snouts. These reptiles are somewhat smaller than crocodiles native to Florida, but telling them apart from alligators and crocodiles can still be tricky for those who haven't developed an eye for their gray, yellow, and chocolate brown splotches or their distinctive ridgeline. The Air Force Base in Homestead, Florida, just south of Miami, is often considered the epicenter of the caiman invasion. No one knows exactly how caimans first arrived on the base. One possibility is that service members stationed there were among the many Floridians who kept the reptiles as pets. When those animals grew too big or the airmen were deployed elsewhere, they tossed them in the waterways surrounding the base, which probably also happened in other parts of Florida and the United States. The temperatures around the base rarely dipped below freezing, and a few of the caimans grew up. By 1974, Homestead was home to a healthy population. The reptiles around the base would crawl onto the tarmac to bask in the sun or clamber up from the water to lounge near the planes. Military personnel worried an accident might happen if a plane hit a caiman while landing. So in 1977, the base launched a counteroffensive. A year-long campaign succeeded in catching 40 adults, 4 hatchlings, and a nest. But by then it was too late. The caimans had spread into nearby Biscayne Bay. Soon they would head north, eventually as far as Cape Canaveral, and even to the eastern edge of Everglades National Park. It appeared the caimans were here to stay. Jake Edwards, an invasive species biologist, can still remember the first time he saw the honey hole. In 2012, when he worked for the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, Edwards joined a survey of invasive Burmese pythons near Biscayne Bay, east of Homestead Air Reserve Base. The crew found its way to a marshy area filled with mangroves and directed its spotlight out into the water. It was like someone had turned on Christmas lights, Edward recalled. The lights were dozens and dozens of caiman eyes. While it's not unusual to find a caiman or two on surveys, Godfrey said, the honey hole was something else. There were probably over 60 caimans in there, he said. They named the coffee-colored waters the honey hole, after the slang term for a beehive that yields a lot of honey. Biscayne Bay remains a hot spot. Of all the places Godfrey and his fellow croc docs patrol, this area has yielded the most caimans. Around the time the honey hole was discovered, people also started spotting caimans within the boundaries of Everglades National Park. And while their overall number remained low, somewhere in the low 100s, invasive species experts were growing worried about the caimans' effect on native fauna. Necropsies of euthanized caimans revealed that they attacked native turtle and snake species that were struggling with habitat loss and road kills. Water infested with caimans, such as the honey hole, also have a suspicious dearth of native alligators and crocodiles, which suggests that caimans are crowding them out. The Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission identified the caiman as a priority species for removal in 2012. So, with the help from the commission, the croc docs got to work. Almost every week since, whether it's 40 degrees or a mosquito-ridden summer day, researchers pick a night and search for caimans. Two-person teams head out at sundown, looking for the crystals and crocodilian eyes that reflect light in the dark, allowing researchers to spot the well-camouflaged reptiles. The team then uses a spotlight to distinguish caimans from native crocs and gators. Catching caimans is a skill, and the croc docs have developed it with time and experience. Over 10 years, they have captured around 250 of the nearly 320 caimans they spotted during their surveys. At just 2 feet long, juveniles can be snatched out of the water with one hand. Older animals tend to be savvier, ducking underwater when a member of the survey team creeps up. Then it's a game of waiting until they resurface and hoping they don't swim or run away underwater. Creeping through the water to find a caiman, you can sometimes get a little too close for comfort before you realize where they're sitting, Godfrey said. Once when he was demonstrating for a group of new hires the proper technique for handling a captured animal, the caiman he was sitting on tried to escape. He was dragged a few feet and got a nasty case of carpet burn. The croc docs caught just 5 caimans in the first year. In 2020, the team set a record of 47, but their catch rate is now on the decline. In July, Godfrey took his team out to the honey hole, and the once teeming pond seemed to host just a single juvenile caiman hiding in the mangroves. Still, juveniles mean hatchlings, and hatchlings mean there are still some caimans actively nesting in southern Florida. On a croc doc survey last week, Brenna Dakin and Libby Sutton, wildlife biologist of the University of Florida, captured a caiman hatchling in a marsh near Biscayne Bay. The tiny foundling, so small the women could scoop it up by hand, means that there is at least one breeding pair in the area. The decline in sightings by survey crews such as Dakin and Sutton might mean that caimans are getting better at hiding. But there's another, more tantalizing possibility. The patrols are working. Art Roybal, a biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Florida, suspects that the croc doc's catch-and-kill technique is behind the decline. It's not the most wonderful job, he said, but the researchers know their species really well. The team euthanizes each captured caiman using a captive bolt gun, similar to the technique used to stun cows before they're butchered. It's a relatively humane way to kill them, and it ensures they can't return to the ecosystem to breed, Godfrey said. Caimans are a good prospect for elimination because they're prevented from moving too far north by the frost line. But non-native animals have a bad habit of popping back up when you least expect it. So getting rid of the caiman for good will take more money, and that's something Roybal says you can't always count on. The funding is never there for invasive species, he warned. Joshua Friars, cultural and natural resource manager for Homestead Air Reserve Base, was more optimistic. I do think this is a species we can successfully eradicate, he said. When Friars started working at the base 15 years ago, one of his responsibilities was to remove caimans that wandered too close to its buildings. He hasn't spotted one in years. Godfrey noticed that in some areas where the team removed caimans, including near the honey hole, alligators and crocodiles had started to reappear. It's hard to say for sure that removing an invasive species is helping the local ecosystem, but the return of native species is a good sign, he says. Invasive species removal is tough, messy, and slow work, Edwards said, but it's worth it, he added. If nobody does it, we're not going to have the Everglades. We're going to have a zoo. This article originally appeared in the New York Times. We'll read one of the obituaries. The Shaft actor who radiated charisma and swagger. Richard Roundtree, 1942-2023. Richard Roundtree strutted across the screen to launch a new era of black empowerment at the movies. From the opening scene of 1971's Shaft, set to the Oscar-winning theme song by Isaac Hayes, the private detective Roundtree played was clearly not the kind of subservient black character that audiences were used to. Dressed in a long leather coat with the collar turned up, the stylish, self-assured, sexually magnetic John Shaft jaywalks across Times Square, giving the finger to a cabbie who dares to honk. He proceeds to beat up pimps, seduce women of all races, and help a Harlem drug lord rescue his kidnapped daughter. The box office smash led to a film franchise, a long career for Roundtree, and a wave of black-led action flicks. Roundtree didn't care for blaxploitation, the word coined to describe the genre, but he took pride in what the films represented. "I know Shaft's a fantasy person," he said, "but the image kids see of him on the screen is of a black man who is, for once, a winner." Roundtree was born in New Rochelle, New York, to a housekeeper mother and a father who worked many jobs, said the Washington Post. At 6'2" and 200 pounds, Roundtree earned a football scholarship from Southern Illinois University, but he dropped out after 2 years, tired, he said, of opposing players who called him the N-word. He took a job modeling for the Ebony Fashion Fair, said the Hollywood Reporter, and met Bill Cosby, who told him he should go to New York to hone his acting skills. Roundtree joined the Negro Ensemble Company there in 1967 and landed Shaft through a cattle call audition. For the adaptation of Ernest Tidyman's 1970 novel, MGM, considered making the characters white, said The Guardian, but director Gordon Parks insisted that the movie be true to the book, which was rooted in black culture. A review in Essence magazine called Shaft the first picture to show a black man who leads a life free from racial torment. With a budget of $500,000, Shaft grossed $13 million, roughly $100 million in today's dollars. It sparked two sequels, also starring Roundtree, which were less successful than the original, as well as a short-lived TV series on CBS. Though often typecast as a detective or authority figure, Roundtree quickly grew beyond his star-making role, said Variety. He went on to appear in nearly 160 movies and TV shows, acting alongside Charlton Heston in 1974's Earthquake and Peter O'Toole in Man Friday the following year. Roundtree played a carriage driver in the blockbuster 1977 miniseries Roots, and years later had recurring roles on The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and Desperate Housewives. His career was paused only briefly when he contracted breast cancer in 1993 and underwent a double mastectomy. He used his fame to help raise awareness that the disease can affect men, and then he kept on working. Nearly three decades after first playing John Shaft, he revived the role in 2000's Shaft, starring Samuel L. Jackson as his nephew, and again in a 2019 movie of the same name. Each time he channeled the director who made him famous. "Gordon Parks is Shaft," Roundtree said in 2019. "He is the most sophisticated, smooth person that I have ever met. To be a part of something that he has his stamp on is magical to me." And flipping over to the Talking Points page, we have the Mike Johnson article referenced in the cover. A Christian nationalist in the speaker's seat. House Republicans finally have a speaker, said Jamelle Bouie in the New York Times, and he's a right-wing fever dream come to life. After three previous nominees flamed out in the face of GOP opposition, Representative Mike Johnson last week won the speakership with the near-unanimous support of the House majority. A four-term backbencher from Louisiana, Johnson benefited from a congenial demeanor and being too obscure to have enemies. But his record is deeply alarming. He worked tirelessly to overturn the 2020 election results on behalf of former President Donald Trump, who enthusiastically backed him for speaker. Johnson has blamed mass shootings on the teaching of evolution and said abortion providers should be imprisoned at hard labor. As an attorney for the Alliance Defending Freedom, a Christian conservative group, he argued in favor of criminalizing gay sex and said that same-sex marriage is a dark harbinger of chaos and sexual anarchy that could doom even the strongest republic. It's profoundly troubling that this extremist is now second in line to the presidency and will preside over the House as it votes to accept the 2024 election results. Johnson dresses like Paul Ryan but acts like Sidney Powell, said Molly Jongfast in Vanity Fair. He not only voted against certifying the 2020 election results, but also echoed the demented fantasy of Powell, the former Trump lawyer, that Dominion voting systems rigged voting machines with an assist from long-deceased Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. He filed an amicus brief in a widely criticized Texas suit that sought to invalidate results in four swing states won by Joe Biden and rallied 125 other House Republicans to sign it. Johnson's election denialism is disturbing, said David Rothkopf in the Daily Beast, but it's his embrace of Christofascism that makes him truly dangerous. He has said that the U.S. is not a democracy but a biblical republic, and like other fascists, appears intent on imposing by whatever means necessary his views on the whole of society. The elevation of a Christian dominionist to House Speaker moves the nation closer to having precisely the kind of government America's founders most feared. For social and religious conservatives like me, Johnson is an inspired choice, said Patrick T. Brown in CNN.com. At a fractious moment marked by Republican infighting, having someone who embodies traditional Republican principles in charge of the GOP caucus sends the message that our priorities will be heard. And Johnson's bona fides as a conservative's conservative might give him some space for prudential deal-making. Don't bet against the Louisianan, said John Fund in the New York Post. Johnson is a smart and talented politician who's impressed fellow members with his command of tax, budget, and defense issues. He has formidable communication skills and a likable, low-key style he can leverage to build relationships with blue state moderate Republicans. He'll need every gift he's got as he takes on the worst job in Washington, said Rachel Bade in Politico. Like deposed former Speaker Kevin McCarthy, Johnson will have to wrestle with the egos, rivalries, and demands of a bitterly divided GOP conference. He'll also have to negotiate with Democrats eager to see him nosedive, and so far he's showing a clear taste for confrontation. Mere days into his speakership, he's cast doubt on Biden's cognitive fitness and infuriated Democrats by insisting that a $14 billion aid package for Israel be tied to a rollback in IRS funding. Since cutting money for investigating tax cheats actually increases the deficit, that makes little sense as a policy matter. But the political logic is impeccable. The libs, after all, were owned. The big question now is whether he'll approach bipartisan talks over government funding, which expires November 17th, in a similarly combative manner. Possibly his fighting talk will convince House conservatives to make the kind of concessions needed to pass a shutdown-avoiding stopgap bill. It was such a bill that doomed McCarthy, said Joe Petriconi in the Bulwark. And Johnson could ultimately meet the same fate. House rules that allow a single member to file a motion to vacate the chair are still in place, so when he starts ruffling feathers, it's not impossible he'll be deposed. Perhaps, said Rex Hupke in USA Today, but it won't change a truth that's now undeniable. There are no moderate Republicans in the House. In elevating an election-denying religious zealot, the House GOP doubled down on right-wing extremism and showed every American the party belongs to Trump. It was Trump, after all, who cleared the path for Johnson by scuttling the speakership bid of Majority Whip Tom Emmer over Emmer's vote to certify the 2020 election results. Disregard for democracy is now the price of admission for a party willing to lie and dissemble and win at any cost to push an agenda wholly out of line with the views of most voters. Every American who cares about the fate of our democracy must pay attention. And let's see, here's a couple of items from the Poll Watch. 42% of voters approve of President Biden's handling of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, up from 35% 2 weeks ago. 65% of Democrats approve of Biden's policies on the war, but just 35% of independents and 20% of Republicans approve of Biden's policies. 34% of Americans approve of the election by House Republicans of Mike Johnson as House Speaker, including 27% of Democrats, 25% of independents, and 54% of Republicans. 27% of Americans disapprove of Johnson's election, while 40% remain unsure. And we will finish out today's program with a quote from Edith Wharton, quoted in Forbes. There are two ways of spreading light, to be the candle or the mirror that reflects it. I like that one. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.